I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is international best-selling writer Pam Jenoff, author of the book The Orphan's Tale. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mevinah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim Barel Chachar and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach, a very happy holiday of Passover. Today is actually the sixth day of Pesach, the week or so long festival of freedom and matzah. Although there are certainly some Jews who believe Passover begins and ends with the Seder, for Reform Jews and for all Jews in the land of Israel, Passover actually lasts 7 full days. For conservative and Orthodox Jews outside of Israel, it actually lasts 8 full days, which means more opportunity to eat that bread of no leaven, that flat baked dough of intestinal affliction, you know, matzah. You see, during this springtime Passover Festival of Freedom, we are commanded not to eat anything with leavening, including especially bread. That means more matzah for everybody. And as anyone who's ever listened to Two Jewish at this time of year already knows, your host, that is me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is not a fan of matzah. In fact, while I love most Jewish food, matzah is a signal exception. Perhaps my favorite Passover joke is, what do you call someone who derives pleasure from the bread of affliction? A matzachist. Sorry. Anyway, I annually complain so much about matzah before, during, and after Pesach that I've actually gotten some serious complaints about my anti-matzah bias. And so to relieve, dear listeners, your collective anguish over my pro-leavening bias, we have a short play-in from Eshat Torah, the Orthodox recruiting organization, that features a Passover parody with the remarkable title, I'm in love with the taste of you, I'm in love with my matzah.
God, you know I want your love, your matzah's handmade for somebody like me. Come on now, follow God's lead, Pharaoh was finished, now you're free. Matzah, the bread of freedom, put on your shoulder, go to the desert quickly. Come on now, follow God's lead, come on now, follow God's lead. I'm in love with the taste of you, needing roll 18 minutes too, although my stomach is falling too, I'm in love with my matzah. Oh, I, oh, I, oh, I. I'm in love with my matzah. Oh, I, oh, I, oh, I. I'm in love with my matzah.
I hope that relieves your stress if you're upset about my anti-matzah crooked news slant. And if you like matzah, as soon as Pesach is over, you can have the rest of mine. You know, one of the most beautiful and poignant moments at any Passover Seder, this year and every year, is the section in which we welcome Elijah the prophet, Eliyahu Hanavi, into our homes. Although he made a belated entry into the Haggadah in the Middle Ages, the ritual of Elijah has now become a favorite part of the Seder for children and adults. The beautiful cup that sits waiting throughout the evening for his delayed arrival is a promise in anticipation, a clue that something more is coming after the meal and thereafter too. Elijah's full Kiddush cup might be the only Jewish food or drink item in all of our history that is guaranteed to remain uningested. Elijah symbolizes hope, the promise of a messianic future of peace, tranquility, and blessing. And what could be a better message at the Festival of Freedom? For the youngest children, the magic of opening the door, turning down the lights, and watching the wine in Elijah's cup lower just a bit. I can hear those voices now. He has to go to so many seders. How could he drink a full cup at each? It's a lovely and lively tradition. For those of us too mature to be swept away by such a ritual, this beautiful custom reminds us of the mystical part of Judaism. It encourages in us the belief that things can indeed get better, that there is always hope for the future. following a tradition my father, Rabbi Baruch Kohan, developed during the Elijah observance at our Seder. We remember the Jewish rebels of the Warsaw Ghetto who fought the hero's fight and died the hero's death. Their revolt began on Passover's Seder night in 1943. There's a poem inviting the martyrs to come in and join in the Pesach observance that concludes, "Elijah, celebrate a Seder for us both." Others take a more lighthearted approach to the Elijah section. One of my favorite stories about Passover comes from Sandy Hackett, writing about his father, the late great comedian Buddy Hackett, you know, the guy with the marbles in his mouth. "Ever since I was a little kid," Sandy Hackett says, "I remember Dad having an open house for Passover. Actors, comics, singers, they were all there for the Seders. One thing vividly stands out in my mind. I went to open the door to let Elijah the prophet in, and standing there was Gregory Peck. He asked me if it was too late for the service. And I said, 'No, go right in. We're all expecting you.' I guess if you open the door for Elijah the prophet and Atticus Finch comes in, you're still doing pretty well." Frankly, it's never too late during this holiday to share stories about your Seders, and it's certainly appropriate to focus on freedom throughout this magnificent festival. To play us in a little more fully, here's a fun contemporary parody from the a cappella group 613, their song Uptown Passover.
This is that age-old Passover tale that's retold. This is what we listen to while eating through those matzah pieces. Climbing, tiling, building Egyptian cities. We worked hard but prayed to God and he freed us all, so get ready.
It's Pesach.
Oh man.
One. There was a burning bush on fire, man. It's Pesach.
Big fan.
One. There's a Pharaoh Jew who got iron, man. It's Pesach.
Change pants.
One. So we took a side of Mizraim. It's Pesach.
Let's scram. One.
So it's bad if you have chametz.
Clean it up.
Kids singing Manishtana. Kids singing Manishtana. Kids singing Manishtana. Cause Uptown Passover's coming to you. Cause Uptown Passover's coming to you. Cause Uptown Passover's coming to you. Seated tonight and we save you a spot. Don't be slaving, just nosh.
Hit it.
Don't be slaving, just nosh.
That was 613's very fun Uptown Passover, with thanks to Bruno Mars. Our guest this morning, Pam Genoff, is a law professor who's written international bestsellers with fascinating premises, including her new book, The Orphan's Tale. Find out what motivated her to explore the unusual junction between circuses and the Holocaust when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Hi, my name is Lauriella, and I'd like to tell you how you can help send children like me to a Jewish day school at no cost to you. Arizona allows its taxpayers to receive a tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations such as JETCO. JETCO is the only tuition organization solely dedicated to Jewish education in Tucson. JETCO provides scholarships to children who attend qualified private schools like Congregation Anshai Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, which educates students from grades K through 8th. You may give up to $1,087 for single tax filers and $2,173 for married couples who file jointly. Jewish education nurtures Jewish identity for generations of students like me, so please go online and visit our website at www.jetco.org or give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. And tell them Lauriella sent you.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish Heart guests this morning. Pam Genoff is the author of the international bestseller, The Commandant's Girl, as well as several other books, including the brand new The Orphan's Tale. She is a law professor. She worked in the State Department. She went to undistinguished universities like Cambridge and Penn, and we're delighted to have her here. Good morning, and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, The Orphan's Tale is a story about a strange liaison and some of the complications of that. Tell us what motivated you to write it.
The Orphan's Tale came out of, the inspiration was two true stories, which I found in the Yad Vashem virtual archive. I was looking in the database of the righteous, and two stories really caught my attention. The first was a horrific account of what was called the Train of Unknown Children, and these were babies taken from their parents, too young to know their own names, and headed for the concentration camp.
Boy, that scene in the book is just devastating.
It's the scene that it broke me to write. And so that was one story that inspired me. And the other was an amazing story that I had never heard of, the Rescuer Circus, a German circus that had sheltered Jews. And so I brought these two stories together fictionally. And in my book, Noah is a 16-year-old Dutch girl who has been cast out by her own parents and is living above a rail station when one night she makes the horrific discovery of this train of infants. And in a moment of fateful impulse, she rescues one of the babies and flees into the night. She finds shelter with this German circus that has rescued Jews.
It's a great premise and a fascinating book. What did you know about circuses when you started this?
I knew nothing. And moreover, I wasn't sure I wanted to, I don't necessarily love the circus. And I wasn't sure I wanted to spend a year with the circus. But the incredible thing in researching this book, first of all, I found centuries of Jewish circus dynasties in Europe, which I'd never heard of, remarkable stories. But I also gained a deep appreciation for the circus arts and the thought and planning and skill that goes into the circus. And ultimately, I found that these were not circus stories. These were human stories of love and heroism that were just so very remarkable.
In the book, you start with a very interesting heroine, you know, not German, not Jewish, a Dutch young woman. How did you come to that idea?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. It's funny. I do like my protagonists tend to be on the young side, although the other one, Astrid, is closer to 40, but Noah's very young. And the interesting thing to me about writing these women during the war, as I've done in the past, is you take someone who through ordinary circumstances would have been on a very set path in life, certain expectations, but because of war or other unforeseen circumstance, they're sort of thrown out of their comfort zone and just changed and tested. So this 16-year-old Noah, you know, she's been kicked out by her parents because she had become pregnant by a German soldier and forced to give up her own child when she's living above the rail station and finds these infants.
We will talk much more with Pam Genoff, the author of The Orphan's Tale, when we come back in just a moment here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from the website or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. There are a plethora of outstanding parodies for Passover these days, including this one, also from 613, with apologies to Ed Sheeran.
Doom, 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 doom. Cleaned the house and got rid of the chametz. Now the seder's where I go. Me and my fam at the table eating matzah like the Hebrews long ago. So come over, we start Passover seder by blessing the wine. Then we wash in our hands. Then we grab the parsley, dip it in the salt water, and break the middle matzah in half.
And now we're singing like, girl, you know I want matzah. Matzah was handmade by my father. for me. Thanking God that we were freed. Let out of slavery in Mitzrayim. Said boys, now we'll drink four cups, spill for the plagues and go on with the Magid. Thanking God that we were freed. Thanking God that we were freed.
Feeling love from my Seder crew. Gonna rock out to Dayenu. Chagadya and Nadiru. Next year in Yerushalayim. Tonight family fills the room. And the kitchen smells like soup. For 8 days we're saying thank you to God who took us out of Mitzrayim. He took us out of Mitzrayim. For 8 days we're saying thank you to God who took us out of Mitzrayim.
Questions again before the meal can begin. And eat the matzah our forefathers ate. They had the leaves swiftly, no time to add yeast. Now we've got unleavened bread on the plate. Take a bite of the mara so we remember the horrors of our lives as the Egyptians place. And for roasted to that, we put it on matzah and then eat hillel sandwich, then shulchan aruch.
And we're singing like, girl, you know I want matzah. Matzah was handmade by my papi for me. Thanking God that we were freed. Let out of slavery, Mitzrayim, say boys.
That was one more cool a cappella Passover parody from 613. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom. Chag Pesach Sameach.
Good morning, Rabbi, and happy Pesach to you as well.
Thank you. We were talking about wine and what makes a wine kosher last week, and you've had experience with that. Some interesting experiences.
Well, I mean, it's clearly not only a question of what's in the bottle and how the bottle is sealed or when the grapes are picked or any of that stuff. It's also a question of who opens the bottle and who pours it. That seems to enter, for at least some people, the question of whether or not a wine is kosher. So I remember going frequently with my brother and his wife when they were newlyweds. They were living in The Hague. I was living in Paris. There was a Tunisian kosher restaurant that they loved in the middle of Paris. And they would sometimes drive down from The Hague just to have like Sunday lunch there, a late lunch. And of course, because this was a kosher restaurant, all the wines were kosher. There was a huge wine list. But the one guy who like carved all the beautiful fruits for dessert and did all the cocktails and all that was not allowed to serve the wine because he was from Mauritius and he looked like an Indian. And we had to wait until the guy who was Sabbath observant and wearing a kippah was available and free to come and serve our wine. And sometimes if it was busy, you could wait 20 minutes for this one guy who was entitled to serve the wine. And I frankly have never understood that and also kind of resented it.
Yeah, so, and this goes to Talmudic prescription, which is still in force for Orthodox Jews, not observed by Reform Jews, certainly not really observed by conservative Jews either, and that is that wine could be used for pagan sacramental purposes. That was the big concern.
Avodah Zarah.
Avodah Zarah, correct. Akum, the worshippers of the constellations and idols and so on. And they would pour out libations. And because of that, you wanted only to have Jews handle the wine once it was opened. That is, once you open the bottle. Handling the bottle before that, not such a big factor. It's a sealed bottle. And, you know, they've known how to seal wine for a long time. They sometimes find it in the bottom in shipwrecks intact from, you know, 2,000 years ago. So, but once somebody opened the bottle or the cask or whatever it was that it was stored in, that was supposed to be a Jewish person serving it. That is still a requirement among Orthodox Jews. If the wine is mevushal, boiled, which we talked about briefly last time, then it's a little less of a consideration, but still many places will require that somebody Jewish serve it. Now, some people feel that's offensive. You know, you're saying that non-Jews aren't as good as Jews. That's not the origin of it in the Talmud, but it's not observed by any liberal Jews today. I should note that the wines themselves don't change whether it's served by a Jew or a non-Jew. But the irony, of course, is some of my Catholic friends have told me that what they often use for wine for sacramental purposes in the Catholic Church
Communion wine, is
Mogen David or Manischewitz.
Right.
About as kosher a wine as you could imagine.
There is an irony there. But, I mean, I'm probably not the only one of your listeners who doesn't get why, okay, the worship of idols or constellations or other things, wine could be used for that, but it's not going to be used for that in the moment that the guy standing in front of you opens a bottle and pours it into your glass, unless he says some like pagan blessing. But most right. people who are going to do that are, you know, dead since 2,000 years.
Yeah. So, on the or let's call it 1,600 years. The Talmud was codified sometime around 450. Yeah, there are certain archaicisms in the way that we handle wine, but the notion of having a kosher wine, particularly during Pesach, when we're very much, many people who don't keep kosher any other time, keep not only kosher on Passover, but kosher for Passover, the hardest time to do it. So it does kind of up the ante a little bit, and it's nice to know that it's a kosher wine, whoever it is that serves it to you. Thanks, Tom. Happy Pesach.
And to you.
We welcome Arshin Shinit Lea Avuno, representing the Weintraub Israel Center and Israel here. Yeah. Chag Sameach, happy Pesach.
Chag Sameach, Rabbi.
Lea, you talked a little bit about Pesach in Ethiopia and for Ethiopian Jews, mm-hmm. the special matzah that they made. And I asked you at the very end of the session, we ran out of time, did you guys eat lamb? Because most contemporary Jews don't eat lamb on Pesach, but did you sacrifice a lamb? How did, as the traditional biblical Pesach would be?
Yes. A lot of people will sacrifice a lamb, and a lot of people would do it really like, just like the Israelites used to do it in the Torah. And it's like a whole... It's a whole thing. The Passover
is like a whole ritual,
like,
process.
Yeah, yeah. Some like random people will do it. Not just the in Ethiopia, the kesim will do it.
So the kes is like the kohen. He's like the yeah. priest of the people. He's yeah. both kind of rabbi and priest for the
exactly.
Ethiopian Jews.
The kes is in charge of anything. He's a psychologue. It's a rabbi, a doctor, everything. And it's really hard to become a kes. Actually, you can only be born to be a kes.
Right.
And that's why they only. But they were the only people that can actually do that.
Do the sacrifice of the lamb
do
for
the
Pesach.
Sacrificing. Right. And when we came to Israel, it started to be less and less common to do.
And because, that's because you didn't have a kes nearby where
right.
you lived?
The kesim, now there is not the same number of kesim. Most of the Ethiopians choose to be a rabbi than a kes because it's easier in some ways. And also, I mean, you don't have to be born a rabbi.
Right, it's not hereditary.
Yeah.
And, you know, if
so,
you're smart
yeah.
and educated.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So now it's not as common to sacrifice a lamb, but so people just do it in other ways, like they go to a rabbi that will do it for them. But everybody brings something to the house, something alive to the house that the fridge is full of meat for Passover. So yeah, and that's also a really, really good dish. The name of it is fitfit matzah.
Fitfit matzah.
Yeah. So fitfit, regular fitfit, is with dairy, and it's every Shabbat morning we eat it. So it's dairy and dabo and challah, the traditional breads, and Passover. It's only meat. You don't eat the dairy, so it's only the meat, and it's like with like meat cubes and like a crushed matzah, and it's really good.
Sounds delicious. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to tell a quick story. When I was in Israel in rabbinical school, I worked, did a volunteer project that I started with Ethiopian Jews who were just coming to Israel in 91 or so, and they put them, because so many had just come, into absorption centers, sometimes with Russian Jews who had just come because the Soviet Union had just fallen, and the two cultures were radically different. And I remember walking by, it was Pesach, and there was a big disturbance at the hotel where they were both staying, because the Ethiopian Jews had brought a lamb and they were trying to sacrifice the lamb and roast it in the backyard, and the Russians were going nuts. So obviously some of that absorption has maybe washed away some of the differences.
Yeah, that's funny. This is Israel. You see all the different cultures meet together. It's really funny.
It is. It's remarkable. Thanks, Lea. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Thank you.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John, Chag Sameach.
Good morning, Boker Tov, Chag Sameach, Happy Passover.
Azizen Pesach,
yes,
as we say.
My favorite holiday.
Oh, my goodness. Except for the matzah, it's one of my favorite holidays. It's definitely in the top 10 of Jewish holidays.
Well, matzah's pretty good for a few days.
You can have mine. So freedom is obviously the central theme. Passover is the ultimate festival of freedom.
We talked about it a little bit last week.
We did, and about how freedom is taught to children and the possibilities of how you can teach them about freedom, but also responsibility that comes with freedom.
Right.
How do you do that in pragmatic terms and tachlis terms in school?
How do you develop that thought process? How do you develop that values base? And, you know,
freedom, and speaking as a parent, you know, it is a hard thing to do.
It is a hard thing to do. And we cherish our freedom, but everybody has different concepts about what that means. As unique as we are as individuals, so too goes our understanding and our beliefs about what it means to be free. So how do you educate youth in a free society? So lots of important things. We start with the foundation in Torah. The great stories of our people are so rich with opportunities for learning with a moral purpose or understanding. And we have this great tradition of debate, of questioning, of challenging and wrestling with ideas, and all that kind of connects to some of the core values of being free. We are encouraged to dig deep, to research, to debate, to express. And in so doing, we're learning. Hopefully we're open and we're listening and we're hearing someone else's point of view. And as kids get older, they learn about world history, about Western civilization. They read classic literature. And through those kinds of studies, there's also an emphasis on fact finding and being informed. There's so much information out there today. It's crazy. And recently we've seen this emergence of fake news. Who's got the fake news? Who's got the real news? And how do you discern and figure that out? So there's critical thinking skills. There's researching skills. And then there's that point of conversation and debate and dialogue that's so essential. The sciences and mathematics are also really great ways to delve into the importance of fact and the importance of observation and theorems and truths. And when you combine the literature and the science and the critical thinking and the opportunity to stage conversations and have discussions, then you provide a framework of thinking and also of actions and behaviors that can help people make good, informed decisions. And I think that having the capacity to make decisions like that enables us to make good choices in our quote-unquote free society.
And to live free and respect the freedom of others.
Right.
John, thanks very much. Chag Sameach.
Thank you. Chag Sameach.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. During one of my trips to London, I became friends with a wealthy yet modest Jewish chap named Hyman Goldfarb. Hyman told me that his huge donations to charities through the years led the Queen to want to knight him, but he was going to have to turn it down. "That's a great honor. Why would you turn it down?" I asked. "Because during the ceremony, you have to say something in Latin," Hyman said, "and I don't know any Latin." "Ah," I thought. "Well, say something in Hebrew," I said. "The Queen won't know the difference." "Brilliant," Hyman explained, but what?" "Well, you know the question the son asked the father on the first night of Pesach at the Seder? Could you say that in Hebrew?" "Of course," Hyman said. "Manishtana halayla hazeh." "Thank you, old sport. I will become a knight." At the ceremony, Hyman waited his turn. Several other honorees went before the queen, had the sword put on their shoulders, spoke Latin, and were knighted. Finally, they called, "Hyman Goldfarb, please approach your sovereign." Hyman knelt before the queen. She put the sword on one shoulder and then the other and motioned for Hyman to speak. And he said, Manishtana halayla hazeh. The queen turned to her aide and said, Why is this night different from all other nights? That was the very old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish just for you and for Pesach. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Shmini, which includes a dramatic incident in which the high priest Aaron's two sons, the Kohanim, priests of God serving in the holy tabernacle, offer strange fire and are immediately consumed by fire themselves. Aaron is distraught. His brother Moses comforts him with God's words, saying, Bikrovai ekadesh ve'alpnei cholam ekaved. By those brought close to me I am sanctified. Before all the people I am honored. In other words, those who die before their time as martyrs are made holy to God, and their sacrifice brings honor to the Lord and the people. This is both troubling and confusing. Judaism, from its beginning, rejected the whole concept of human sacrifice. In the story of the Akedat Yitzchak in Genesis, God instructed Abraham to ritually offer up his beloved son Isaac. But then God reversed course and demonstrated to Abraham and all of us that we are never again to sacrifice a human being for religious purposes. And yet here in Shmini, those who have just been ordained priests, leaders of the sacred services that bring us all closer to God, are literally turned into korbanot, burnt offerings, in the very place where they lead worship. How do we reconcile this? Rabbis and cantors sometimes joke that this is still the way we treat religious figures in Judaism. First, we raise them to high office to lead worship, and then we immolate them from bima to ashes in one shining, flaming moment. But in a larger sense, the way in which we engage the idea of sacrificing human lives for a greater good is complex and disturbing. In contemporary society, we often speak of tragic deaths as a kind of human sacrifice. In war, a soldier dies to save others' lives or defends a homeland or an ideal. When a child dies, we sometimes say she is with God now, or he is in a better place, or she was a little too good to live on this earth. When a person dies of an unexpected illness or a violent event, we explain that they have taught us to value each day as sacred. It is a rationalization for loss. We are trying to explain what truly is beyond our understanding. But in another sense, this attempt to explain the impossible pain is also a sanctification, a way of finding and preserving holiness and meaning in a world in which things sometimes simply don't make sense. As we will seek to do with Yom HaShoah, our Holocaust Remembrance Day, and as we can do in our daily lives, we honor the memory of those we love by acting in ways that create holiness, goodness, and blessing. And sometimes we can then find comfort for our tragic losses. When a young person dies from an illness, we try to mobilize research to find cures or preventive measures for that ailment. When senseless tragedy kills innocents, we attempt to change the way our society deals with issues like gun violence or mental illness. When migrants die in the desert, we're moved to attempt to break that terrible cycle. After the loss of his sons, Aaron will go on to serve as the high priest for many years. His work actually brings God's presence into the midst of the people, and in his personal conduct he becomes known as an Ohev Shalom Verodef Shalom, a lover and pursuer of peace. Loss motivates Aaron to heal others and to seek to make life more holy for everyone in the community. May it be so for us in our own times of distress. May we too learn to work to create sanctity and bring healing. Then we will have accomplished what God, through Moses, tells the grief-stricken Aaron, Bikrovai ekadesh, by those brought close to me I am sanctified, and through our lives and efforts, God too will be honored. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, author Pam Genoff will explain how she writes such compelling stories about Jews, about circuses, about the Holocaust, and about Europe. Find out when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, Israel condemned far-right French presidential candidate Marine Le Pen for saying publicly that France is not responsible for the deportation of thousands of Jews to Nazi death camps in 1942. This declaration is contrary to historical truth, as expressed in the statements of successive French presidents who recognized France's responsibility for the fate of French Jews who perished in the Holocaust, Israel's foreign ministry said in a statement a day after Marine Le Pen said that French responsibility for Holocaust deportations did not lie with France. She said it during an interview with major media outlets in Paris last week. The Israeli ministry added, this recognition underpins the annual events marking the anniversary of the expulsion of the Jews from France and the study of the Holocaust and the educational system in France, both of which are important elements in the battle against anti-Semitism, which unfortunately is again raising its ugly head. Marine Le Pen, the head of the National Front Party, is at or near the top of polls, was asked about the roundup and deportation of 13,152 Jews from the Velodrome d'Ivre, the Vel d'Ivre statement in Paris, July 16th to 1742. The Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem defines it as a symbol of the responsibility of the French nation for the Holocaust. Marine Le Pen responded, I think France is not responsible for Vel d'Ivre, and added, I think generally and in very general terms indeed, if anyone is responsible, it is those in power at the time, not France as such. It wasn't France. Since the National Front was established by Marine Le Pen's father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, the party has been accused of espousing anti-Semitism, hatred of Muslims, and xenophobia. The elder Le Pen has been convicted multiple times for Holocaust denial and incitement to hatred against Jews. Under Marine Le Pen, the party has softened its image, kicked out anti-Semitic members, including the founder, her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was excluded from the party in 2015. France will hold its presidential vote April 23rd. If no candidate wins a majority, a runoff will be held between the top two candidates on May 7th. Marine Le Pen and the centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron are the frontrunners in the polls.
I never tell the truth. I exaggerate. I make fun of blacks, whites, Jews, Jews. We're the chosen people. We had a few bum breaks. I must admit that. The Red Sea trick.
Don Rickles, the master insult comic who created laughs with ridicule and sarcasm in a decades-long career that earned him the facetious nickname Mr. Warmth, he died last week at the age of 90. Rickles was born in Queens to Jewish immigrants from Lithuania. He said he developed his brand of humorous mockery because he was no good at telling traditional jokes. The New York-born Rickles had an intense, often ad-libbed, rapid-fire delivery and a wide, impish grin. He delighted nightclub audiences, Hollywood royalty and politicians, and TV audiences by hurling invective at all of them, all in good fun. When he encountered Frank Sinatra for the first time during a stand-up act in 1957, Rickles greeted the mercurial singer when Sinatra walked in with a retinue of tough guys by saying, "Make yourself at home, Frank. Hit somebody." Luckily for Rickles, the line amused Sinatra, who became one of his biggest boosters and took to calling the short, bald Rickles Bullet Head. They were close friends throughout the rest of Sinatra's life. Rickles flourished on the Johnny Carson show, with whom he had incredible chemistry.
Johnny, I say this from my heart. I've been proud of you, and I've enjoyed working with you. And I say this very honestly. Don't ever hang around me.
Don Rickles played Las Vegas always and every roast in history for 50 or 60 years. He was in more than 25 movies, believe it or not, including voicing Mr. Potato Head in the Toy Story films, had a couple of TV series, and he won a Primetime Emmy for a special about his life and comedy. And he insulted every celebrity and did so with panache, mock anger, and sharp humor. However, in private, Don Rickles had the reputation of being one of the nicest men in Hollywood. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Pam Genoff. She's the author of the novel The Orphan's Tale, a really fascinating and dramatic, I don't want to call it just a Holocaust story because it's more complicated than that. Pam is a lawyer, teaches in a law school, has worked in the Foreign Service, served at senior levels in the State Department and as a special assistant to the Secretary of the Army. Has had quite an interesting and complicated career. What brought you to writing novels?
So my story actually begins about just over 20 years ago. I was sent to Krakow, Poland, as a diplomat for the U.S. State Department.
By the way, that's an amazing place, Krakow. It's just a fantastic city.
I adore it. Absolutely. Beautiful place. Wonderful people. So I was sent there as a diplomat, and I did not go to work on the war. I went to stamp visas and passports and help Americans when they got in trouble over there. But it was a very unique moment in time in the mid-90s when Poland had just come out of decades of communism, during which they really could not have an open discussion. And as a result, there were many issues from the Second World War that were frozen in time, issues of anti-Semitism, property restitution, preserving the concentration camps. And these issues became very important because Poland wanted to join NATO and the European Union. Politically, that could not happen unless they made progress on their issues from the war, you know, their Jewish issues, if you will. And I was this young girl in Poland, no cell phones back then and no internet, so you're really quite cut off. And I did what I thought any nice Jewish girl would do. I gravitated toward the surviving Jewish community. And so I was at shul every Friday night, and it was Orthodox, which was new for me. And I was at the rabbi's every Saturday for lunch. And the U.S. government, the consulate, seeing my relationship with the people, gave me responsibility for the Holocaust issues. So that became my job. You know, if Elie Wiesel was upset because Polish Boy Scouts put crosses on the field where his family died, I would go try and work it out. Or if Hillary Clinton, as First Lady, wanted to tour Auschwitz, I would go there with the Secret Service for a week. So as you can imagine, it was tremendously difficult and tremendously rewarding work. And I came back from that experience changed and knew I wanted to write about it. So that's kind of where it all started for me.
But what a fascinating time. You know, really, in a way, as you said, the World War II issues, the Holocaust issues in Poland had been frozen for 50 years under communism, and then just sort of it unearthed. This particular story, The Orphan's Tale, you know, it's very captivating. It reads really like an adventure story, almost cinematic. Do you feel about it that way?
I do see it like, you know, I do see it in my mind. So I start with that opening image. And of course, I would love for it to become a movie. Yeah. But, you know, from your mouth to God's ears.
Yes, indeed.
but you know, it's just one thing. I mean, my first loyalty, that would sort of be the icing on the cake. And my first loyalty is to my readers. And, you know, I'm just grateful that the book has been well received.
The circus stuff, did you, you know, actually try any of this?
I did not. So the first question for me was, do I need to go see the circus? And I didn't necessarily want to, because as I mentioned, I'm not a huge circus fan.
A deep-seated fear of clowns, perhaps from childhood, or...
You know, I'm not a clown phobic. It's just, you know, not my love. I know a lot of people struggle with the animals and, you know, what happens there. And so ultimately, I did not go see the circus because the European circus of yesteryear is so very different from an American circus that I thought going to see it would actually distort the research. You know, I might get it wrong. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of, you know, a lot of book research, a lot of old films. There's all sorts of websites devoted to circus arts. And then I had an aerial list because my character, you know, when Noah hides with the circus, they say she can stay, but she's got to blend in. And the circus director says that she should become part of the aerialist act, which is the flying trapeze, among other things. And Noah has to learn flying trapeze from Astrid, who is a lifelong aerialist from her own Jewish circus family, now defunct. And Astrid is charged with teaching Noah how to, you know, how to perform the flying trapeze. So part of my research, a lot of it had to do with flying trapeze. And I had an aerialist on retainer. By on retainer, I mean she was helping me for free. And I would ask her questions, but it wasn't until almost the end of the book that I knew what I wanted to ask her. You know, how can you throw a person this way? And, you know, how, you know, and how many people does it take to do such and such? Those were the kinds of questions.
How did Jews get into circuses? You know, is this any kind of a job for a nice Jewish boy or girl? In Europe.
Well, here's the incredible thing. When I started researching the book, I found an actual book in a library, in the library at Rutgers. I found a book that talked about Jewish people in popular German entertainment from about 1870 through the beginning of the war. And one whole section of that book was devoted to Jewish circus dynasties. And I had never heard of this, but there were these amazing families, the Blumenfelds and the Lurches and other families who had been in the circus business for, you know, 100 plus years. And these families had 12 or 13 children. They often had multiple traveling circuses. By the end of the war, they were largely wiped out, not just due to the war, due to other circumstances as well. But it was such a rich history. And so while that's not the focus of my book, I was able to set Astrid in one of those circus families.
It's a fascinating setting and just not one you expect in a book, and particularly in a book about a Jewish story. Tell us a little bit. Your background is so diverse. You worked in the State Department, as you said, in Europe, but not just in Poland. You also worked as an assistant to the Secretary of the Army, helping the victims of Pan Am Flight 103 get a memorial. I mean, you've done you worked on the site of the Oklahoma City bombing. These are challenging experiences. Do you find that they influence your writing? Do they affect the kind of writer you are?
Well, they do. And so when I finished grad school, I was over at Cambridge reading history. I had the opportunity to become the special assistant to the Secretary of the Army. And I did that for about a year before I became a diplomat. And I view it as the year that I saw the world from the shoulders of giants, if you will. So that's a paraphrasing Sir Isaac Newton. But, you know, I had the chance with my boss to, you know, help the Pan Am Flight 103 families with their memorial. We were at Oklahoma City a few days after the bombing, you know, to observe the rescue and recovery efforts at that point. And I also had the chance to go around the world with him to the 50th anniversary of World War II commemoration. So we were in Bastogne and we were in Corregidor in the Philippines and just really incredible places. And that was my first exposure, actually, to Eastern Europe and to that part of the world, which I'm very gripped by. When I'm in Eastern Europe, I feel a real sense of Yiddishkeit and a real, like, sense of the people and the place, despite the horrors of the history. You know, it's a place I connect to on a very deep level.
You know, I had never gone to Eastern Europe till a couple of years ago when I went on a sabbatical trip, and I have to say it feels exactly the same way to me. I never wanted to go to Poland. I have lots of ancestors from there and lost people in the Holocaust. And yet there's something unbelievably gripping about that part of the world. Do you think you'll continue to write about it?
I do. I mean, it's interesting. So The Orphan's Tale is not set in Eastern Europe, right? The circus starts in Germany and right. They travel to France. And part of that was, you know, my trying to imagine. I couldn't find out just where the circus had gone. I knew it was still in existence. And at that point, it was simply more plausible that they would have been able to perform in France than, say, Poland, you know, with what was going on then. So I don't know. I've also done books set on the home front as well. But I very much regard my books as love songs to Jewish Europe and to the people that lived in that most difficult and complex of eras. And so I don't know that it will always be set there, but I think I'll always come back there in some way.
What's your next project?
I am working on a book that involved 12 female agents who worked for Britain during the war and went missing in Europe, never to be heard from again. And there's that part of the story, there actually were these female agents that that disappeared. And what I'm exploring in my fiction is what happened to them and whether or not they were betrayed and, you know, what this means about the relationship of people who serve their government and the government's larger aims.
In writing The Orphan's Tale, there's a great sense of loss kind of woven through the whole thing. How do you think it all ends up?
After the story ends?
Yes.
Oh, interesting question. So I don't actually know. And I, you know, sometimes for me, it's a little black around the margins. Like it's a little dark where I don't always see what might have happened off the page. It's reality that, you know, some people were found and some were lost and some we just don't know about. But what I want sort of people to take away from it is not the loss, but it's the light. You know, it's the heroic moments. And really, this is a book about finding home in the least likely of places. So I hope that, you know, I hope that all my characters find home in some sort of way would be, you know, sort of an important takeaway for me.
In creating characters, do you think of them sort of at the start and then work them into the story? Do they develop over the course of the story?
Well, I have a very unorthodox writing process. So I know many writers who are linear writers and they pen one sentence after the next perfectly until a book is done. That's not me. I'm what they call a pantser, a seat of the pants writer. So I open a computer with an image and I go blah for like 60,000 words of whatever comes out. And it's the worst way to write a book because, you know, the editing is awful on that, but it's the only way I can do it. And so my characters evolve very organically through that process. Sometimes I'm writing down dialogue and I'm not sure even who's speaking it at that point. It's just coming out. And then there's almost like a sifting, you know, or like a fossil dig where you're sort of, you know, brushing off the thing you found to see what's really underneath. That's how I view it.
And then once you've done that, you have to reassemble the whole skeleton?
Correct. So at some point that document, maybe after 3 or 4 months, gets really unwieldy. And that's the point at which I start doing chapters and outlines and, you know, putting it in some sort of order. But that takes a really long time.
And then you realize that what you had somebody saying in the 15th chapter actually had to be predicted in the third chapter, or you kind of have to refix it all, or does it come out? Yeah.
It doesn't come out well. There's a lot of cutting and pasting that goes on and many months, you know, in the darkness there. But, you know, ultimately, this is my 9th book. So I know at some point a light will shine through and it will start to look like a book. But that moment, it can be seriously delayed.
It's kind of like Talmud almost. Somebody has to redact it after, but that somebody is you.
Yes, I'm the redactor as well. I don't have anyone else till it's all done.
All right, this is a tough question. What's your favorite book out of the ones you've written? You've written 9.
Out of the 9, that's like choosing between children.
Everybody
that's really
says
hard.
It that way, I know.
That's really hard. I mean,
Yes, but you know, they won't have hard feelings.
Well, The Orphan's Tale, I will say, is kind of on a different level for me, both creatively in terms of the difficulty and also, you know, in terms of how it's done and commercially. So The Orphan's Tale is probably my favorite. But people do return a lot to Commandant's Girl, which is where it all started 10 years ago. So I'd go one or the other there.
I want to thank Pam Jenoff for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her book is called The Orphan's Tale. It's available, as all books are, on Amazon and everywhere else. And where can people go to find out more about you?
Well, my website is simply pamjenoff.com, PamJenoff. But I would like to say one of the greatest things of the internet age is the ability for readers and writers to connect on really a sustained and meaningful basis. So I invite everyone to find me on Facebook or Twitter or email or wherever you are hanging out online.
It has changed the reading experience, I think. I do hope they make a movie out of it. It would be remarkably cinematic, especially the circus scenes. And, well, I don't want to give away too much about the book. Pam, thanks. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none.
from traditional services to the unique. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas Newborn, the newly installed Orthodox woman rabbi at Temple B'nai David Judea in Los Angeles. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website and friend us on Facebook. Our playout from our Passover playlist of particularly pleasurable passages of Pesach parody song comes from a group called Improbably Wise Studs. It's their parody of La La Land called That's How Passover Is Done. My friends, have a Chag Pesach Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and kosher rest of the holiday of Passover, a Zisen Pesach, a joyous Passover, and a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week we pray of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.